morning is number 004297, William Thompson against the John J. Madden Mental Health Center. Mr. Andre.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. This is a situation which often arises, the temptation, obviously, to deal with the backlog drives, unfortunately, district judges to go towards summary judgment, which respectfully is not always warranted. In this case, what Judge Connelly essentially did was to weigh the evidence and to make credibility determinations, which are things that under summary judgment principles are simply not appropriate. This is a case where my client had no history of prior discipline. Nonetheless, after an incident that occurred 2 months after he complained of discrimination in a letter to the EEOC representative of the agency, the state agency, he received a 7-day suspension. Now, what's notable about this is one of the charges of the three that were made against him that resulted in this 7-day suspension was that he took a lunch without authorization. The interesting point is that another person in the same position he was in took lunch at the same time around the same circumstances and received absolutely no discipline. She was white, he was black. Additionally, my client was charged as part of these three different issues with essentially botching a Black History Dinner. But again, in the same incident involving the same set of circumstances, another white employee by the name of Kevin Kelly, who was responsible for assisting in putting this together, admittedly didn't do his job. He received no discipline. My client received discipline. The difference is my client's black, he's white.
Well, but your client was the one responsible.
My client was not the only one responsible. My client had the overall responsibility. It was admitted that Kevin Kelly had the responsibility to prepare a list, which he did not do. That might have some justification in saying that my client should get a stiffer discipline than Mr. Kelly would get, but that doesn't justify Mr. Kelly not being punished at all and my client bearing the entire brunt of the discipline as a result of the failed dinner.
Did Mr. Thompson have the authority to delegate the task to Mr. Kelly?
No, that was admittedly by all parties, that was simply done. It was admitted that he had the responsibility. I don't know quite who gave him the responsibility. And it was admitted that he didn't carry out the responsibility. We're not saying here that my client, because he was in the hierarchy.
Forgive me, you're not saying that Mr. Thompson didn't delegate the responsibility to Mr. Kelly, are you?
No, we're not clear whether he did or didn't, but the point is that it's admitted by all parties that he had the responsibility and that he failed in that responsibility and that he received absolutely no discipline whatsoever. Now, if we were arguing whether or not the discipline my client received compared to some discipline that Kelly received was disproportionate, there may be some room for argument. But in this case, there was absolutely no discipline that Kelly received at all. So, again, what the judge did here was to weigh, without allowing a jury to make a determination, that his feeling was that these things would not allow a jury to reasonably determine that the reason for these distinctions being made between Mr. Kelly and my client and Ms. Leibich and my client, who was the lady who took the lunch, that they were based on race rather than some other reason. Well, obviously, any party has a right to make their pitch to the jury and to make their spin to the jury and say, we believe that there's no evidence or that the evidence is minimal, that this is race as opposed to some other legitimate reason. It cannot be argued that no reasonable jury could find that these things were being done based on race, and particularly given the other supportive evidence. For the previous year, the only persons disciplined at the facility were blacks and Hispanics. There were no whites. And for the prior years, the evidence shows that only one white in all those years ever received the type of discipline my client received. That's also important because in making determinations about whether a person has been discriminated against, you can also look at what are the normal policies and practices. And this was supposed to be a progressive discipline situation. And this was a situation where my client had no prior background. He didn't get a written reprimand, a verbal reprimand. He immediately got a 7-day suspension. Now, arguably, some jury could find, well, we don't think that's discrimination. But what the summary judgment determination is that no jury could reasonably find that this is discrimination. And that's where we feel that Judge Connelly respectfully erred in his determination, particularly given the fact that there are contradictory statements between the parties, even as to whether or not they kept statistics on whether there was discipline administered on the basis of race. Ms. Madden, who's the head of the facility, saying no, there aren't any. Ms. Varso saying there were, and we actually produced statistics that she presented to us, showing that, you know, there was disproportionate treatment. So under the circumstances, we feel that these present material differences in facts that only a jury could resolve, that they have to weigh, not the judge, and that they have to make credibility determinations. Counsel in his brief astutely points out that a court is not supposed to act as a super personnel department, but at the same time, the courts have also said that courts are not supposed to act as super juries either. And so that has to be balanced off in the determination to be made. And while it may be tempting to try to make quick determinations to free up the court's docket, it's not appropriate under the circumstances, particularly in a case like this where no one comes out with smoking gun evidence of discrimination. People simply don't admit to that. In some cases, they're not even aware consciously that that's what they're doing. So we feel the discrimination determination was wrong, and it should be reversed. We also feel that the determination of retaliation was wrong. The judge admitted that my client was disciplined within 2 months of the time that he wrote a letter about discrimination. Now, the judge makes a big point of the fact, and so does counsel, that he didn't identify was it sex discrimination, race discrimination, or what. Well, in the opposition portion of the retaliation section of the statute, it doesn't fine-tune it quite like that, that you have to say race versus sex or whatever. It's admitted that he indicated in the letter that he felt he was being discriminated against. And also, the point is made that some of the parties involved say that they weren't aware that he wrote this letter 2 months before he was disciplined. They only found out later. But they constructively had to know, this is the agency, 2 months before he had written a letter about discrimination. It is at least something that has to be weighed by the jury, whether they really did know or didn't. I would like to reserve the balance of my time for a rebuttal, if I could. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andre. Mr. Huska.
Your Honor's opposing counsel, may it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Richard Huzek, counsel for the defendant, Madden Mental Health Center, and I urge the court to affirm Judge Kennelly's entry of summary judgment in the defendant's favor in this case, both on the discrimination count and on the retaliation count under Title VII, because there is no evidence sufficient to support a finding by a jury in the plaintiff's favor on either count. Let me direct my attention first to the discrimination count and focus on the critical facts here. As my brief outlines, it is the defendant's position that the plaintiff has not made a sufficient case for two of the elements of a prima facie showing under the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting analysis, either that he was fulfilling his job responsibilities or that similarly situated employees received more favorable treatment. There's no issue that he's a member of a protected class and that he received an adverse employment action. The defendant's position throughout this entire employment issue was that the plaintiff fell down on the job 3 times in a 10-day period, and there's ample evidence of that. It's undisputed. The plaintiff essentially admitted that these are things that he did wrong. He tried to lay off blame on others and somehow pass off responsibility, but he admitted the essential facts.
How long had he worked there?
I think he'd been working with the agency for 18 years and at this facility for approximately 8 years or 6 to 8 years at the time. So he had a long, good history, and I think that in part reflects the relatively modest discipline that he received after a long, good career. They didn't terminate him. They didn't suspend him for 30 days or longer. On the scale of progressive discipline that's imposed for this type of infraction, the statistics that the plaintiff has pointed to show that similar suspensions were imposed upon other employees for less severe conduct, neglecting their duties and leaving work without approval. In this case, the plaintiff had done not only neglecting his duties with respect to a patient that he left unsupervised, but also failing to attend a scheduled activity where he was the activity coordinator, and in addition, the serious problem with respect to his failure to see to it that the dietary staff had a list of the attendees for this Black History Month dinner, with the result that there was a double production of lunches for some 50-odd people. And essentially, I think the comparison of the plaintiff with other employees, since they seek to put great emphasis upon this comparison element of the prima facie case, it's important to keep in mind that the plaintiff was essentially guilty of falling down on the job with respect to these three relatively serious performance deficiencies within a 10-day period. The plaintiff seeks to focus heavily upon the statistics or the comparisons with other employees, and I think the record does not bear out his position that we have a jury question presented by any of those statistics. With respect to the comparison of other employees supervised by the same supervisor, it is true that the supervisor had not imposed a suspension upon any white employees in the previous 12 months. But that's only a piece of the necessary proof that the plaintiff would have to adduce to show that there is a similarity. He'd have to show that some white employees had engaged in similar misconduct and had not received similar discipline. Such evidence is entirely lacking. Likewise, with respect to the comparison with the white activity therapist, Ms. Liebich, who went to lunch after coming back from a museum outing, setting aside for a moment the fact that she was supervised by another person, the failing proof is that she had a scheduled activity that she missed, like the plaintiff. In fact, there's no proof that she missed any of her job responsibilities that she was required to attend to when she went to lunch after coming back from the museum. In this case, the evidence is undisputed that the plaintiff had a job activity that he was supposed to go to, but instead blew it off so that he could go to a class that he found out was available at the last minute, and then used an excuse for doing so without authority, even though he knew he had to have such authority, that, well, he was running behind on getting the number of continuing professional education credits that he needed within the facility, and so he just decided not to bother to go through the required steps to be able to take that class. So he both had an activity that he failed to go to knowingly, unlike this other activity therapist, and he also violated the established requirement that any such departure from activities require the approval of the supervisor, which he failed to get. Perhaps the most emphasis by the plaintiff is put upon the failure to come up with a list of attendees for the Black History Dinner. And the plaintiff's argument is that he delegated to Mr. Kevin Kelly, a white rehabilitation coordinator, he's not an activity therapist, the responsibility to come up with a list of the people that would be attending the dinner and bring it back to him, Mr. Thompson, the plaintiff, and didn't do so. And I think there is no real comparability or similarity of the situation between the two for several reasons. One, the overall responsibility was Mr. Thompson's, which he doesn't dispute. He had simply asked Mr. Kelly to get the list and bring it back to him. So Thompson knew that he didn't have it back from Mr. Kelly, made no effort to follow up and see what was going on and get it so that it could be delivered to the dietary staff in time. He was essentially the boss in this arrangement, and Kelly was the inferior or subordinate for this temporary delegation of responsibility. In addition, Mr. Kelly wasn't supervised by the same person. He was supervised by someone else, and he had no other infractions that would have added up to the degree of severity that was experienced here. And finally, even Mr. Thompson admits in the record that Mr. Kelly was sick and ill, and I believe out of the office or away from the facility during the period leading up to this. And to the extent that's relevant, I think it would provide a sufficient explanation for the supervisor, for Mr. Kelly to say, okay, you were sick, you didn't get back to Mr. Thompson with the list that you were supposed to do, but we're really comparing apples and oranges here when we're trying to put so much emphasis upon that. But even if Mr. Thompson were to satisfy the elements of a prima facie case of discrimination under Title VII, I think the difficulty in this case is that the employer has offered and presented plenty of evidence of a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for his decision. And in those circumstances, the plaintiff who bears the burden of proof throughout all phases of the case has to present evidence sufficient to support a finding that the real reason given by the defendant was truly a lie, that it was a pretext, that it had nothing to do with the discipline and the job deficiencies committed by the plaintiff, but it was really because of his race, and there is not a shred of evidence to support that. There is no showing of any racial animus by the decision maker. There's no showing that the input with respect to any of the information regarding this was tainted by racial animus. There isn't any evidence that evidentiary support of the decision had no factual basis whatsoever. Essentially, we have nothing, even if we'd gotten to the third prong of the burden-shifting analysis, to support a conclusion that what we've got is pretext. And that is why I suggest that it was the function of courts in these cases to determine whether there's a tribal issue of fact regarding the state of mind of the defendant being actually discriminatory as opposed to imposing a legitimate job discipline. And really, there is none such here. I mentioned in passing that the plaintiff has argued that there was conflicting reasons given by the defendant for what happened here. That's simply incorrect. The consistent, universal reason given by the defendant was job deficiencies by the plaintiff. The fact is that both statements that he refers to as reflecting such an inconsistency are correct. The organization does not keep statistics by race and gender of job discipline, but when ordered in response to the EEOC investigatory process to identify the race and gender and degree of discipline of people that have been disciplined in the past, they could pull up that information and listed it, and it appears along those lines, not as some statistical compilation, but simply as the relevant underlying information. I don't think there's any inconsistency there, nor can anything be made about it, and it simply does not constitute conflicts between or inconsistencies in the reasons given for the discrimination. I look to the letter on the retaliation claim. The defendants respectfully submit that it does not reflect protected expression. He complains of harassment. He doesn't say sexual harassment. He says that I'm just being treated unfairly. He says that he's been discriminated against because he has to seek coverage for benefit time off. But he doesn't say that any of it has to do with his race. There's simply nothing about that that relates to...
Oh, but a jury surely could infer that he reasonably believed he was complaining about race discrimination. I mean, in the letter, he repeatedly uses the word discrimination, harassment.
Judge Rovner, I respectfully submit that I must disagree with your position, that the use of those words doesn't per se constitute something that would constitute or justify a finding that he reasonably believed he was the victim of race discrimination or gender discrimination. And if you disagree, then I'm going to have to defer to your opinion on that issue. Ultimately, again, on the pretext consideration, I think the same evidence applies. There's not a shred of evidence to support the proposition that either any of the decision makers knew about this letter, constructive knowledge isn't enough, or that the disciplinary decision was a pretext for retaliation against him. Again, I urge the court to affirm summary judgment in the defendant's favor. Thank you so kindly.
Thank you, Mr. Hozek. Mr. Andrew?
My brother has made a great argument to pitch before a jury, and that's where it should be pitched. But it shouldn't be determined that his argument cannot be the base or the evidence here cannot be the basis of a reasonable jury determination. And that's the issue here. Counsel argues, for example, that the letter didn't constitute protected activity. Well, the judge never made any ruling like that. In fact, the judge did indicate that with respect to that issue, that the letter did show that there was suspicious timing that took place between the time he wrote the letter and the time he was disciplined. He conceded that. So that's not even on the table here for us to argue about. Again, my brother creatively brings it up, but it just wasn't a part of the judge's opinion here. The other thing is that counsel again brings up the issue of pretext. Again, that was nowhere in Judge Connelly's decision. He never said that there was no evidence of pretext. In fact, in the arguments we made before him, we addressed the pretext issue, but that was never addressed in his opinion at all. He simply made a determination concerning prima facie evidence and whether it was there or not. Third, counsel talks about he wasn't fulfilling his job responsibility. Judge Connelly's opinion, again, never mentioned anything about the fact that my client wasn't fulfilling his responsibility. There was some discussion there, but in the discussion, he never made the determination that my client was not fulfilling his responsibility. In fact, he made the point that my client's still working as an activity therapist there. The other thing is, my client denies engaging in misconduct. He's not saying that other people should have been disciplined just like he was disciplined. The point he's making is he should not have been disciplined the same as those other persons were not disciplined, because his conduct, however you want to put it, which he interprets and which the facts show were not any violations of any rules or regulations, don't deserve punishment any more than the conduct of Kathy Leibich or the conduct of Kevin Kelly or anybody else. Counsel seems to make the argument that we somehow think that these people should be punished, and our argument is that none of them should have been punished. We respectfully ask that the decision be reversed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Andrey. Our thanks to Mr. Andrey and to Mr. Huzzack for their fine presentations today. This case also will be taken under advisement.